I'm going straight in and ask, if it's one thing you can change in one Formula One, what would you change?
I think a lot of things actually, but that's the nature of Formula One. It's a changing industry, and we change. As Scott just said, my job is 90%, almost 100% technical, but definitely 95%. I don't get involved too much in the commercial or political side of the sport. But the sport, Formula One, is something that's moved very quickly. And regulations change very fast, technologies change very fast. So, and I think that's very important for F1 to retain that. And there's, if the Formula One ever got to a point where it wasn't changing quickly, it wouldn't be Formula One anymore. So, but for most outside industries, especially the people we deal with that are non-Formula One people, they're normally sort of staggered by our development rates. At the same time, you have to say, compared to other equivalent industries such as automotive or aerospace, we're not good long-term planners. You know, our idea of long-term is 12 months. Their idea of long-term is 25 to 40 years. So whereas 12 months for us, something's finished and out of date. So we operate in a very different environment. So that's why, to be honest, you don't really get, it's also probably quite difficult for F1 engineers to be successful going into those type of industries, because they can probably bring some things to show people how things are possible, but they'll probably just wreak havoc in most of those industries. And vice versa, we'll get people coming into F1 from outside, they can't respond quick enough. So in terms of what you say, what would I change? I think in recent times, probably over the last 10 years, there's areas where Formula One has slowed down a little bit. I'd probably free it up more. And there's technologies from my point of view that I'd love to develop, like active suspension and items like that, the CVT transmissions that have been on F1 cars before but that are currently banned. And they were banned at the time probably for good reason, because they were very expensive technologies. But to be honest, an active suspension car, we could put active suspension in the car for probably 30 or 40 grand now. Whereas it was probably used to be 2 or 3 million quid, you know, 15 years ago. So it's a completely different set of technology now. So it's off the shelf almost, the hydraulic systems and actuators that we use. So if I had to change one thing, I would free up the regulations more. With still some overall control on for things like lap time for safety.
Yeah.
So you know, they start getting ridiculous on lap times. You need to, but you can do all that with tyres and engine power. So.
We get the impression with Williams, the ultimate privateer team, doesn't have a budget to just throw at the car, that perhaps your philosophy is more work smart with the money that you have. Could you discuss a little bit about how financial constraints work and how it helps and hinders you?
Well, everyone's got some sort of constraint, and sometimes not having any financial constraint can be worse, because you try and do too much and you invest a lot of time and people into things that really are third or fourth order. Whereas at Williams, we have to concentrate on first and second order performance programs, because if we don't, and we use that money, we can't afford to spend money on tiny little things, because they're too expensive and you don't get any return from them. So it just means that we're very focused on the areas that we have to be focused on. I don't think that we've got to the stage ever where we can't do something that we want to do. It's more we consider something and say, well, actually that's not a good thing to do. So even if we had lots of money, we'd rather put that money into something else than spend it on something small. So because of that, we inherently become efficient. You know, we're always looking at where our best return for our money is. So you're probably right that in some ways, because we're a private team, we're not manufacturer owned, we have to look at what we're spending our money on. But I think we have to see things in a positive light as well. We've got to look at it. We can't, you know, walk around saying, oh, we've got no money, let's not do anything. It's completely opposite. We've got to say, here's our pot of money and this is what we're going to spend it on.
I think a good example of something where you've been really innovative is perhaps your flywheel cars.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little about that?
Well, it's quite a big project. We have a separate company called Williams Hybrid Power, WHP. And actually, just for the record, we have two KERS systems. We have a battery KERS system and a flywheel KERS system. So we sort of backed two horses, if you like, to make sure we didn't miss out on one of the technologies. It's it's very innovative because no one's done it before, which means that the time to bring it to the track is quite long and indeterminate. We don't know when it will be on the track. There's obviously a lot of discussion about whether, you know, Kerr's role in Formula One in the future. But as far as we're concerned, we can see it staying. We can't see it going back, so we're still heavily investing in that. The flywheel has been really interesting because it's a, you know, it's running at over 50,000 RPM, runs inside a vacuum, and it's got its own issues and problems you've got to deal with that are quite different to anything else. To be honest, it's similar in a lot of ways that a lot of things that we design in Formula One, you can't go down the shop and buy one. So you've got to sit there, you've got to build it, you've got to break it, you've got to do the stress calcs on it, put it back on the dyno, break it again, and that's how you do R&D. And flywheel definitely falls under one of those categories. It reminds me a little bit of seamless shift gearboxes that are now turnkey in Formula One, but 5 years ago no one had them, and it was one of those projects that you knew what you were trying to achieve, but at that time it was quite difficult because no one had done it before. But now it's not even a conversation topic, to be honest. And I think that's the way Kerr's will be in 3 or 4 years' time.
How important do you think it is for Formula One to be green? I mean, you know, nobody's recording when you are. Nobody's saying, oh yeah, you're Toyota or Williams just for Marsh and Gallon.
No, it definitely doesn't do that. Yeah, I think there is. And I think that it's something that we've started to adopt more and more over the last 3 or 4 years. Kerr's is part of that, yeah. To be honest, in terms of an area where Formula One can use its sort of R&D thirst, if you like, for lap time to say, if you get Kerr's working, it's worth 3 or 4 tenths. That's enough for a Formula One engineer to say, right, we're going to pile tons into that, which means that we can develop things a lot quicker than other industries. And I think that's why that's a good feedback on the green front. I think in terms of actually just looking at things like how much fuel the cars burn during a race, I think it's so tiny, that's not really where we consider the best way to look at where you look, you know, to say that you're green because you've saved 2 or 3 miles a gallon on the engine. Because if you look just at our fuel consumption, yeah, but I think that's a tiny part of what Formula One does.
Yeah, I mean, I'm talking about in terms of just giving an impression of attempting to be green in all types of technologies and the way it does its business.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, green is not our first priority. Exactly, our first priority is to go fast. And it's if we can be green at the same time and that helps sustain Formula One into the future, then that's good. And I think there's a lot of areas where we obviously have green policies within the factory on how we use materials and how we get energy. But that stuff's it's worth doing and we need to do it. But what you really want to see is Formula One trying to lead something green. And that's why I think energy recovery is a very good story for Formula One. Because yes, we're going around, we're putting on a show, ultimately, because we're putting on a race that people want to watch. And they want to be entertained by that. But also, we're developing technologies that should, in the future, not just help road cars, but help mining, rail systems, anything that moves, basically. There's a couple of very strong applications in energy systems, for example. Flywheels are a very good example, and one of the reasons why we invested in it as well, in that they've got prototypes that, you know, have flywheels spinning underneath railway stations. A train comes in, hooks into that flywheel, spins it up to 100,000 RPM while everyone's getting on and off the train. Yeah. And then when the train's ready to go again, it hooks back in the flywheel and spits it out the other side. So the train's basically stopped and started again with no sort of energy requirement.
Yeah.
And the same thing for things like trucks and mines. All dump trucks, you know, you've got these, you know, multiple ton dump trucks carrying hideous amounts of weight, and all they're doing is going up and down. They're going from the bottom of the mine pit to the top of the mine pit.
Yeah.
And that's a perfect, absolutely perfect way to use an energy recovery system, because you've used the let's say you start at the top, and using the braking energy of the car or the truck as it's going down into the mine, stores energy up, takes its load on, and uses the energy to get back to the top again.
Yeah.
It'll never be 100% efficient, obviously, but it can take a significant amount of consumption out of it. So I think more Formula One can go down those sort of paths. That to me is more valid than
yeah.
you know, us going from 15 mile to gallon down to 12 mile to gallon, because the engines are so specific to Formula One.
Yeah.
Sure, there's areas that it can translate to, but I don't think that's going to mean anything to fans or to the people who are concerned about environment. They couldn't care. They'll still say, well, 15 mile to gallon is still pretty poor for an engine, so I don't think that becomes relevant. Yeah.
That's one quick question. Could it be offered a chance for Jake Pavlik to drive an F1 car? Have you driven one yourself?
No, I haven't, no.
Would you like to?
It would be interesting to drive it, just to see what you guys talk about.
Yeah.
I'm
sure it's technical direction, you'd have to get your hands on the thing you're responsible for.
You would do, but I think the implications of a shunt for me financially would be too much. So, it's a Philips competition, they're all covered on there, so I'd have to go and pay for spare parts if they crash them.
Did you try the simulator?
I've driven the simulator before, yeah. Yeah.
Did you ever want to be a driver, or did you always want to be an engineer?
No, I realised quite early on that I should concentrate on engineering rather than driving. So.
You talk. I was wondering something about the development, about the timeline of development. Could you sort of talk a little bit about that?
Well, I think if you look at any examples compared to road car industry or something.
Just here for the F1 cars.
Yeah, I mean our normal timeline for a Formula One car from start to finish is 6 or 7 months. We have little projects that start off before then, but basically when we sit down and say, right, here's our piece of paper, here's two or three things that have been put into that. For example, at the moment we haven't fixed our chassis for next year yet, and that will run in the first week of February. So regardless of what happens in the middle, we will achieve that sort of time frame. So you're talking about, let's say, six months for a car from blank sheet of paper to running on the track. The same equivalent time for road car programs, about 7 years from them starting from scratch there. So it's, you know, 14 times better than that. And I think it's only, we do things differently to road car. We've got different objectives. So our cars in some ways are more complex because they've got higher technology on them. In other ways are simpler. We don't have to worry about noise and vibration. If you go and drive a Mercedes or something, it's very important that it rides over ground properly or survives in all multitudes of weather conditions. That doesn't mean anything to us. So even just looking at their sort of sign-off procedures, where they go and do 100,000 miles in a desert somewhere with a road car, we don't do that sort of thing. We have very stringent crash tests for safety, so we've got to pass a lot of FIA dictated tests from front, side, rear, and that's an important part of our design as well.
What's your favourite thing about working for Williams?
I think the two guys who run the company are really dedicated to motor racing. Over the years, they've won a lot of races and championships, and the impressive thing is that everything they've made out of the company, they've invested back into the site. You won't walk onto another site like this that's owned by a privateer team because of the investment here. And in fact, there's a lot of manufacturers that would love to have a site this big in terms of equipment. So that's quite encouraging to know that, you know, their whole focus is just Grand Prix racing. So that's what keeps you motivated to us. That's very good motivation. They both work every day of the week, every day of the year, more or less. They're real sort of 7 day a week people.
So you still get the same excitement now, you wake up on Monday morning, it's like, I work at Williams, that's really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. No, you still do that because as I was saying at the start, the job change, the business changes so quickly, there's no time to get bored in Formula One. You just don't have time to, because there's always something new every day. You're just going so quickly on everything.
Bit of a difficult question, but I think we have to ask this one really. Referring back to the weekend and what happened in the F2, I wonder if I can ask, will Williams have any technical input into the investigation to what happened with that car?
Yeah, Williams will be involved in that.
Just ask one final question, and we're short of time, so thanks very much for taking the time to spend with us this morning. Just in relation to the Philips competition, obviously you're heavily involved in the selection process for that, the winner, lucky Joe Pavlik, that gets to drive the car. Can you just tell the guys a little bit more about what it is you look for throughout the time the guys spend at Palmer's 4 and then here at the factory to determine who is the best person to drive the car?
I think the main thing that I look for, and there's obviously a filtering process before it gets to me with other engineers and driver instructors. By the time we get down to the last 10 people that I'll review and then meet the last three or four, the main thing I'm looking for is maturity and someone who I know is not going to go and try and prove they're the next Michael Schumacher. It's because it's more important for me to know that someone's actually come in, they're going to be safe, and they're going to listen to what you do, what you tell them to do. That's because on a day like the day that we'll do with the it's all run properly, but no one's going to go out there and impress me or anyone else from Williams enough to say, right, let's sign him up to be the next test driver, because it's a lot more complicated than that. So the main thing we want to do is see someone enjoy themselves, have a very good first-hand experience of what it's like to drive a Formula One car, but also be sensible enough to know what they're told. And that comes through all the driver trainers that Jonathan has at Palmer's. They know what we're looking for, and they can pretty much, they've just seen so many people from, you know, the big hero who turns up and wants to prove to everyone that he is the next greatest thing, to the people who, all right, this is really good fun, I'm sensible, I'm going to listen. So I really look for someone who's mature in terms of their outlook, and someone who, you know, you can tell if someone's listening to you straight away. If you're telling them something, do this, they're either, yeah, I'll do that. That straight away to me tells me someone's not listening and they're not going to do that. So that's what I look for. I think there's lots of other tests that we do, obviously, physical tests and the simulator tests and things like that. That person, even if we get people that are sort of, you know, hopefully we get to the end where there's three or four people who are capable of driving the car, but they've still got to pass things like driving through the simulator, because the cars are so complicated. To know what to do with the electronics on the steering wheel and everything, you can't go and learn that on a track at Silverstone, because you're driving down the, as you're driving in the pit lane. So that's why it's very important to pass a series of other tests in addition to my criteria. There's a lot of technical and physical tests that they go through.
Brilliant. Well, hopefully Jeff's here now to tell us a little bit more about that process. So, Sam, thanks again for your time.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone. Cheers.